Now he rode west to explain things to his wife, and when she expressed her disappointment about his heading back to trouble, and at his age, he said simply, "The world is a muddy place, and if good men don't try to clean it up, bad men will make it a swamp." Emma Rusk often suspected that she was having so much trouble with her white son, Floyd, because she had rejected her Indian son, Blue Cloud. For although she lavished unwavering love upon Floyd, he refused to reciprocate. At the beginning, he had been a normal child, robust and lively. But from the age of 6, when he began to realize who his parents were and in what ways they differed from other fathers and mothers, he began to draw away from them, and it pained her to watch the bitterness with which he reacted to life. He was not difficult. He was downright objectionable, and she sometimes thought that it would be better if he moved in with the rough-and-ready Yeagers, who might knock some sense into him. His principal dislike was his mother, for he saw her as unlike other women, and on those painful occasions when he came upon her without her nose, he would blanch and turn away in horror. But it was when he became vaguely aware of how babies were born that he suffered his greatest revulsion. For he had learned from other children in the stone houses about his mother's long captivity with the Indians and of what they had done to her. He was not sure what rape involved, but he had been told by eager informants who knew no more than he that many Indian men had raped his mother, and from the manner in which this was reported, he knew that something bad had happened. He thus had two reasons for his antipathy: his mother's physical difference, and the fact that she had been abused by Indians, and it became impossible for him to accept her love. Whatever she did, or attempted to do, he interpreted as compensation for some massive wrong in which she had participated, and in time he grew to hate the sight of her, as if she reminded him of some terrible flaw in himself. He grew equally harsh toward his father, for he had learned from the same cruel children, who, like others their age, were eager to believe the worst and report upon it immediately, that his father was a Quaker, not like other people. They said that he was so cowardly he refused to fight. At the tank, which he and Mr. Yeager had fenced in, this man Poteet forced him to back down. He was scared yellow. In an area where a gun was the mark of the man, the fact that Earnshaw refused to carry one proved this charge. There had also been an ugly incident in which a wandering bad man of no great fame had stumbled into Fort Garner and tried to hold up the place. He had chosen the Rusk residence for his first strike, and finding Earnshaw with no gun, had terrorized the place for some time before Floyd escaped and ran screaming to the Yeagers, "Pop's being shot at by a robber." Within the minute, Frank Yeager had dashed across the open space of the parade ground, burst into the Rusk home, and shot the befuddled gunman dead. As they stood over the corpse, Yeager repeated something he had said before. "Earnshaw, a Texan without a gun is like a longhorn without horns. It just ain't natural." So now, if Floyd saw his mother as stained because of her experiences with the Indians, he saw his father as emasculated, because Frank Yeager had been forced to protect the Rusk household. He was therefore a bewildered, unhappy lad as he approached his teens, and it occurred to him that he must do something about the deficiencies in which he was enmeshed. Concerning his mother, he could do nothing except continue to repel the love she tried to bestow upon him. But the glaring faults in his father's character could be corrected. For one thing, he could behave in a manner totally unlike his rather pathetic father, and he began in a calculated way to make this adjustment. He went to Jaxifer. "If I can get the money, will you help me?" "Maybe." "How much must I give you for a pistol?" "Now what do you need a pistol for?" "Like when that man came to our house." "Yep, man ought to have a pistol, time like that." It was agreed that Jaxifer would provide Floyd with a revolver in fairly good working order and some shells for $6, and now the problem became how to accumulate so much money. In these troubled days, the United States government did not provide enough currency to enable men to conduct their businesses, This did not mean that there wasn't enough to provide charity to feckless idlers who refused to work. It meant there wasn't enough to pay the men and women who did work. The cause of the trouble was avarice. Those fortunate few who already had money, or who worked at jobs whose salaries enabled them to acquire some, saw that it was to their advantage to keep the national supply meager, for then those who lacked funds would have to work doubly hard to earn a portion of what the well-to-do already controlled. On the Texas frontier, cash was in such short supply, thanks to policy decisions formulated by the money masters in New York and Boston, that hard-working cowboys, like the two black cavalrymen, rarely saw actual cash, and when they did, it was apt to be Mexican, French, or English coins dating from the 1700s, with Spanish coins circulating at a premium. It was a great system for the rich, who could command excessive rates for the money they had acquired. A miserable system for people endeavoring to accumulate enough funds to start a business or keep one going. Earnshaw Rusk, a man of uncommon insight, saw early the great damage being done by the monetary policy of his nation. For although he and Emma had gained their start through the large land grants obtained by her family and from the free horses and cattle that roamed the prairie in those earlier days, he was aware that others who followed were having a desperate time. Out of regard for them, he wrote frequent letters to the defender, explaining his interpretation of the money problem. By imperceptible steps, none consciously taken at the time, he progressed from being merely aware of the problem to a free silver man who argued that silver should be cast into coins at a much greater rate and at a higher value than was now being done, to an avowed greenbacker who pleaded for the printing and circulation of more paper money, to an incipient radical populist who believed that the government ought to protect and not harass its citizens. Long before a much greater orator and thinker than he took up the subject, Earnshaw was warning the people of Larkin County that we are slaves to gold, and people in the growing town began accusing Rusk of being a radical, a socialist, and an atheist, giving his son reason for being an opponent of his father's social beliefs. A loud adherent of religion as practiced by Mrs. Yeager, and a strong advocate of guns. In one of his letters to the editor, Earnshaw had said, I do believe the same family income buys less and less each week, even though the total supply of money diminishes. This is self-contradictory, and I cannot explain it. The cause was simple. Floyd Rusk was systematically stealing as much as he could from both his mother and his father, and after he had paid the cavalryman more than $2.50 for the promised gun, his father caught him taking 2 Mexican coins. What in the world is thee doing in that jar, Floyd? I was looking at the different coins. Thee knows thee is not to touch that jar. Nobody is except thy mother, not even me. She told me I could. It was obvious to Earnshaw that his son was lying, because Emma so treasured the few coins she was able to hoard that she allowed no one to approach them. Rusk knew he ought to have a showdown with his son here and now, but he evaded it, because to do so would necessitate involving Emma. He knew that she was already in difficult straits with her headstrong boy, and he did not want to exacerbate this. So the moment of significant challenge passed, and Earnshaw said weakly, "Don't touch that jar. Thy mother wouldn't like it." He did not report the affair to his wife, nor could he guess that his son had stolen from his savings, too. It would have appalled him to know that the combined thefts totaled nearly $6, a considerable amount, and he would have been even more distressed had he known that these thefts had been planned and conducted over an extended period of time. His son was in training to be an accomplished thief, and before the year was out, he was a thief with a very good army revolver hidden in an unsuspected corner of the Rusk house. Fort Garner buzzed with rumors when Ranger McNabb rode back into town. He knocked on the Holly door to ask if he could stay there for a few days, during which it became apparent that he had come to deal with Rattlesnake Peavine if he could flush out that murderous fugitive. Floyd Rusk, possessor of his own gun, was at McNabb's side constantly, asking for pointers on how real gunfighters handled their weapons. And Otto told him a secret the boy chose to ignore. Only one, son. Know you're right and keep coming. When Floyd asked if it was true that he was after Peavine, Otto said, "Rangers are always after whoever's done wrong." And then he disappeared, heading south. But Floyd, a student of shootings, told Molly Yeager, a brash child with her own interest in such matters, "When a ranger heads south, you can be sure he's really going in some other direction. McNabb is heading west to see if he can track down the rattlesnake." Floyd's guess was correct, for after a long detour to the south, McNabb made easy adjustments in his heading, winding up in the general direction of Palo Duro Canyon. As he approached the deep depression, he saw signs which tempted him to turn sharply southwest to where a tiny settlement lay across the New Mexico border. As he rode into town, it was like 100 other episodes on the long frontier. A ranger comes cautiously into a village, looking this way and that, asking a few questions, nodding, and passing on. But this time, as McNabb headed toward the western exit, a small, wiry man in his late 60s watched him ride past, waited till he was a few feet down the road, then slipped out, positioned his left arm to serve as a platform, and pumped 4 quick bullets into the ranger's back. With supreme effort, McNabb held himself in the saddle, aware that he had been most savagely hit, but hoping that the shots might not be fatal. With what strength remained, he turned to face his assailant, who now blasted Otto square in the face and chest. Without a sound, the little ranger slid from his saddle and fell awkwardly into the New Mexico dust. 5 Texas Rangers set out to kill Amos Peavine, and they tracked him for many weeks, coming upon him one morning at 7 in a dirty eating house near Phoenix, Arizona Territory. When the coroner examined the body, he found that it had been shot 7 times in the back, twice more from the left side, and twice more from the right side, well to the back. Considering the rattlesnake's long reign of terror and the relief at his justified death, the coroner saw no reason to publish the fact that the Rangers had killed him with 11 bullets from the rear. When Floyd Rusk, back in Fort Garner, heard the news, he told Molly Yeager, "I'll bet he died like a man. I'll bet all 5 of the Rangers was terrified when they came on to the rattlesnake." Floyd, the would-be gunman, had learned the value of money through stealing enough to purchase a revolver. His father would now learn in an equally perilous game. Although he had scrimped on his family's expenditures and paid his savings into the bank to reduce his loan, 1885 found him with $135 still outstanding. And cautious though he was, he could not seem to get ahead by that amount. Of course, he paid the interest regularly, because he knew that if he didn't, Mr. Weatherby could declare him in default and take his ranch away from him. The terms of the mortgage were quite clear on this, and the possibility so terrified Rusk that he was usually a day or two early in paying the interest. But now, when money was tightest, he saw that the banker had another stranglehold on him. For on 2 occasions recently, Mr. Weatherby had suddenly and arbitrarily called mortgage on unsuspecting ranchers and farmers. That is, he had demanded full payment at a time when he knew the rancher had no chance of paying it. In each case, according to Texas law, the rancher was judged to have been in default, which meant that if the bank let the man keep his homestead, house and small acreage attached, it could claim title to the rest of the ranch and thus accumulate valuable land. "That was so unfair," Earnshaw cried when he heard of the second foreclosing. "A man spends $2,000 for his land. He spends another $2,000 improving it. For 7 years he meets every mortgage payment, and then, because he can't come up with $175, he loses everything." Rusk often misunderstood business details, and this time he had the situation only partly right, for in the case cited, when the bank foreclosed, it was merely to obtain its outstanding debt, $175. When the ranch was sold at a sheriff's sale, any income beyond that belonged to the former owner, But now the trick was to rig the sale so that either the bank or someone associated with it bought the ranch for a pittance, which meant that there was little or nothing to be returned to the original owner. When Rusk found out that the courts, the newspapers, the churches, and the customs of the countryside all supported such moral thievery, he became so enraged that he felt compelled to protest in the Defender. Surely the Grange and the Farmers' Alliance are right when they argue that the laws of a nation ought to support the homeowner, the small businessman, the young family trying to get started. No law should allow a bank to deprive a man of his residence and his means of earning a living. If the United States had arranged its affairs so that money was more reasonably available, then the paying off of a mortgage could be done, and people who refuse to pay should be punished. But the nation keeps the money supply so constricted that even a prudent man cannot accumulate enough cash to pay his debts, much as he would like to. Something in our society is badly wrong when a good rancher like Nils Bergstrom loses his ranch because he cannot get his hands on a little cash. No one read Earnshaw's letter with more anger than Banker Weatherby, and when the economy was at its depth, he informed the Rusks that he must demand the balance of his loan, $135, payable as the contract stipulated within 30 days. "But thee promised me thee'd never do this," Rusk protested. And Weatherby said, "Conditions have changed. The bank must have its money now." Then began the month of hell, because in all of Fort Garner or Larkin County, too, there was no one from whom the Rusks could borrow that missing $135. There were ranches worth $6,000 or $7,000, counting land and cattle, which had less than $30 in cash. And these meager funds were so necessary to keep the place operating that to lend them out would have been impossible. The Rusk themselves, with a ranch now worth nearly $9,000, considering its fencing and cattle, could assemble less than $50, and Mr. Weatherby would not consider any partial payment. He was entitled by law to his full amount, and he intended to collect it or take over the ranch. In despair, Earnshaw laid the prospects before his family. "Through no fault of our own, we stand to lose our ranch. Emma, thy cattle were never better, but we can't sell them to anyone here. Floyd, we pay only a little for thy schooling, but it can't be continued. We must all try till the last legal day to find this money, and if we fail, well, others better than we have failed before us." As he said these words, the awfulness of his family's position overwhelmed him, and he wept, an act which sickened his son, who said boldly, "Someone ought to shoot that Mr. Weatherby." "Floyd," his mother and father cried simultaneously, and the force of their words so startled him that he caught his breath. Yet it was he who proposed the one solution which had any chance of saving this family. "Mr. Poteet'll be coming along soon. Why not ride down to meet him?" As soon as the boy said this, his parents recognized the good sense of his suggestion. And before nightfall, Earnshaw Rusk and Frank Yeager were headed south to intercept the cattle drive they knew would be coming north. There were no Comanche now to endanger them, and there was no risk of losing their way. For over the years, the thousands of cattle heading north to Dodge City had beaten the plains into a wide, rutted path which a blind man could have followed, and in its dust they spurred their horses. On the first full day out, they came upon one small herd headed for Dodge, and its riders said, "Poteet can't be far behind. He never is." On the third day, they saw a huge cloud of dust, like something out of the Old Testament, when the Israelites were moving across their desert with the help of God. And they galloped ahead with surging hopes that this might be Poteet. It was, and as soon as he heard of their plight, he was interested. "It's criminal for banks to take over so much land, and for the government to protect them in doing it." He sat astride his horse, with only the left foot in the stirrup, as if he intended to dismount. But first he wanted to talk, and the three men kept moving their horses as he did. "You got yourself into this trouble, Rusk, through buying that fence. It was against reason and against nature. Now comes the dreadful penalty." Rusk did not try to defend himself. He was concerned only with the loan he sought. and at this point he could not detect whether Poteet was going to lend him the money or not. But as the talk proceeded, it became clear that the drover sided with the Rusks and not with the bank. "Of course I'll lend you the money. How could I not?" And before night fell, Earnshaw had the funds with which to save his ranch. "It's not a loan," Poteet said, when the two men tried to thank him. "It's an appreciation for the business we've done." He paused to recall those rewarding years. Then, "You know, Rusk, you mustn't think too harshly about Weatherby. He's just a part of the system." "What does thee mean?" Earnshaw asked. "Life in Texas is like a giant crap game, a perpetual gamble. To succeed, you need grit, courage to take the big chance. Those who succeed, succeed big. 100 men tried to drive cattle up this trail. They failed. Some of us, like Sanderson and Peters and me, we took great chances, and we succeeded big." He seemed to be right about Texas. Everything was a colossal gamble. "Years back, Rusk, when I saw you gambling so heavy on that barbwire, I disliked you for what you were doing to the range. But I had great admiration for what you were doing in your own interest." "Why does thee say a money-grubber like Weatherby is necessary?" "Because he's the agency that punishes us when our gambles turn sour. He's the right hand of God administering castigation. You escaped him this time, but don't tempt him again, because if Texas is bountiful in rewarding gamblers, it's remorseless in punishing those who stumble." When Rusk and Yeager left Poteet next morning, they rode hurriedly back to Fort Garner, where they reported to Emma and Floyd, "We are, through the grace of God, saved." They then went to the bank, where, with a certain bitterness, they counted out the $135. And now a drama which was being enacted in many small Texas towns unfolded. Banker Weatherby, frustrated in his attempt to steal the Larkin Ranch by legal means, surrendered to the fact that the Rusks were going to be the leading citizens in the town. Knowing that he must in the future do business with them, he now displayed no disappointment or ill feelings. With what seemed unfeigned enthusiasm, he cried, "I'm so pleased you could scrape up your final payment. It's always good to see a successful rancher make his land prosper." Then he made an offer which staggered the men. "Now, you don't have to pay in full. If you wish to extend your mortgage, the bank would be most happy." "We'll pay," Rusk said. "Are you two men partners?" "Yes, in a manner of speaking. When a man serves me as well as Frank Yeager has, I give him part of my profits. He gets the 200 acres north of the tank." "You should enter that gift at the land office," Weatherby said. "It's always best to have things in writing." In early 1885, Rusk and all forward-looking people in Fort Garner were electrified by the news. The Fort Worth and Denver City Railroad is planning to resume. And men began to dream. "Now maybe we can get a spur to drop down into our town." In 1881, men of great ambition in Fort Worth and Denver had tried to link their two cities by rail, and had started bravely to build west from Fort Worth, but had run out of money during the tight times of 1883. Their line had reached only as far as Wichita Falls, north of Fort Garner, where it came to a painful halt. But now, with more prosperous times looming, workmen were being rehired and iron rails ordered. When the good news was confirmed, Rusk became a cyclone of energy, his tall, awkward figure moving ceaselessly about the town and to ranches outside to learn whether they might join in offering the nascent railway special cash inducements if its engineers agreed to drop a spur to the south. In this enterprise he was prescient, because the histories of Texas written a century later would be filled with doleful entries recording the death of similar communities. Pitkin, founded in 1866, flourished for a few decades in the later years of the 19th century as a center for collecting rural products. But during the railroad boom of the 80s, the town fathers refused to grant the railroads any concessions. The tracks bypassed Pitkin, and before the turn of the century, the town had died, the last resident leaving in 1909. Rusk, with his keen sense of how the West was developing, realized that the continued existence of the town depended upon attracting some railroad that would speed its growth. Originally, he had dreamed of inducing the main line of the FW and DC to swing slightly south through Fort Garner, but that plum had been lost to Wichita Falls. However, he could now logically aspire to a spur, and he was determined to get one. To that end, he hectored local citizens to contribute funds with which he could approach the railroad barons in Fort Worth in an effort to convince them that a spur south was in their interests. Grocer Simpson contributed enthusiastically to the fund, with which Earnshaw would approach the railroad men. And the flourishing proprietor of the Barrack Saloon also chipped in, as did Editor Fordson. Ranchers east of town were shown the advantage of having a railroad for their cattle, and ordinary citizens who wanted to be united to the larger world were invited to join the crusade. But Rusk was astounded at the man who volunteered to do the major work. The campaign had been underway only a few days when Banker Weatherby came voluntarily to the Rusk home, asked to be invited in, and spoke with a warm sincerity which belied the fact that recently he had tried to steal the Rusk lands. "I am hurt, Earnshaw, that you did not come to me first with your plan to bring a railroad into our town. It's vital that we get one to come our way." Having said this, he contributed $1,000 to the invitation kitty, and then proposed that he and Rusk leave immediately for Fort Worth, where decisions concerning the route were being made. Rusk had wanted to cry, "Look here, Weatherby, not long ago thee tried to steal my land. Now thee invites me to travel as thy friend. Why?" But he remained silent, because vaguely he understood that Weatherby was merely playing the game of building Texas. In July, Banker A does his best to steal Rancher B's land. But in August, A and B unite to hornswoggle Rancher C. Texas poker, someone called it, because sooner or later B and C would be certain to gang up on Banker A. As they rode, Weatherby coached Rusk as to how they must approach the railroad men, and how to make them an offer of cash rewards if they could swing the roadway south. By the time they reached the hotel where the FW and DC directors were meeting, these two rural connivers were prepared to talk sophisticated details with the big city bankers and engineers. Alas, they were one of 19 such delegations, and by the time they reached the decision-makers, the route was set. "Gentlemen," the directors apologized, "we're grateful for your coming to see us, and we appreciate the offer you're making, for we know that such sums cannot be collected lightly. But we must allot all our funds to the main line to Denver. There can be no spurs." Rusk was crushed, and like a child he showed it. But Clyde Weatherby, an adroit negotiator, masked his disappointment, wished the Colorado and Texas financiers well, and concluded, "Later on, when you do have enough money to run a spur south, and sooner or later you'll have to, because we're going to amass great riches down our way, I want you to remember us, Fort Garner, Garden City of the New West." They obviously liked this jovial man and assured him they would remember. But on the return trip, Weatherby told Rusk in the harshest terms, "Earnshaw, I like you, but we've got to work in an entirely different way. The future of our town is at stake, and we either get a railroad to come in or we perish." Before they reached Fort Garner, he had a plan. "Let me have all the money. I'll spread it around where it'll do the most good. You put up 30 or 40 of your acres, and I'll do the same with mine." "What will thee do with them?" "Give them to people who will determine where that first spur to the south goes." "Why?" "To buy their support, to be sure of their votes when we need them." "But isn't that bribery?" "It is. And so help me God, it's going to buy us a railroad." If Rusk had been tireless in his initial work, Clyde Weatherby was remorseless in his follow-up. Yet at the end of 6 hectic weeks, he had to inform Earnshaw, "I've handed out all the money and accomplished nothing. There's no hope of a spur south." "Are we doomed?" Rusk asked. for already he could see in other aspiring towns the dreadful effect of having been bypassed by the railroad. "We are not," Weatherby snarled, as if he were furiously mad at some unseen force. "The people we gave money and land to will remember us. But now I'm asking for one last contribution from everyone. We'll see if the folks in Abilene have vision." And off he went to the new Texas town that carried the same name as the famous old railhead in Kansas. Before he left, he told Rusk and Simpson, "If they won't come south to meet us, by God, we'll go north to meet them." But when he came home, with no money left and no promise of anything, he told his co-conspirators, "Nothing now, but in this business you plant seeds and pray that something good will spring out of the ground. I have seeds planted everywhere, and I give you my word on the Bible, something is going to start growing before another 5 years pass." So the men of Fort Garner watched hopefully as the years passed and the railroads inched out to other places, but not to theirs. 3 weeks after Francisca McNabb had buried her husband in the family cemetery overlooking the Pedernales, she received word from the Capitol in Austin that her younger brother Ernst had died at his desk in the Senate chamber. It had happened at 9 in the evening, when the Senate was not in session. He had been working late. So within a month she had to conduct 2 funerals. And this reminded her of how very much alone she now was. Her mother had died some years ago. Her beloved father and her youngest brother Emil had been killed in the horrid affair at the Nueces River, and now Ernst and Otto were dead. The sense of passing time, of closing episodes, was oppressive. Her 3 children, with her encouragement, were preoccupied with their own responsibilities. But this left her in sad loneliness. She experienced a strong desire to reestablish contact with her only surviving brother, Theo, who had gained statewide attention in 1875 by his heroic work in rebuilding the town of Indianola after the destructive hurricane of that year. More than 40 places of business had been wiped out by the raging waters of Matagorda Bay, more than 300 lives lost. And when scores of older men announced that they were abandoning the site, Theo had stated to the Galveston and Victoria newspapers, "I'm going to rebuild my ship's chandlery bigger than before." And he had done so. Encouraging other businessmen, he had been responsible for the rejuvenation of the destroyed town and watched with pride as it returned to prosperity. His own store, which serviced the many ships that sailed into Indianola, doubled in size, and his agency for the Gulf, Western Texas, and Pacific Railway Company established him as Indianola's leading merchant. He conducted his affairs from an office which stood at the land end of the pier that reached far into the bay. Here he greeted captains of the Morgan Line steamers as they docked with cargoes from New Orleans. Despite the obliteration of so many businesses in that hurricane, Theo continued to envision Indianola, where he had first set foot on Texas soil, as the state's gateway to the West, and his letters to Fredericksburg displayed this optimism. "If you walked with me down our main streets, you would think you were in New Braunfels, because 2 names out of 3 would be German. Seligson, Eichlitz, Dahme, Remschel, Thielepappe, Willemin. This is a real German port, with hundreds like me who saw it first from the deck of their immigrant ship and liked it so much they never left. We have our own ice machine now and are no longer dependent upon the refrigerated ice ships that used to bring us river ice from New England. We have a new courthouse, several hotels, at least 6 good restaurants, shops with the latest styles from New York and London, our own newspaper, and all the appurtenances of a city. You would like it here, and any of you who tire of farming in the hills ought to move here quickly, for this is a glimpse of old Germany installed in new Texas." Franziska, welcoming such letters, wondered whether she should move permanently to Indianola to be with her brother for the remaining years of their lives. But after several months of cautious consideration, she decided against leaving Fredericksburg, for too many of her cherished memories were rooted there. And Otto had loved the Pedernales, the wild turkeys strutting through the oak groves, the deer coming to the garden, the hurried quail in autumn, the javalinas grubbing for acorns. However, in the spring of 1886, Theo did send a sensible letter. "With Otto and Ernst gone, you and I are all that's left. Come spend the summer with me, for I am lately a widower. Besides, it's much cooler here with the sea breezes each afternoon." Turning the care of the farm over to Emil's children, all of them married now, she took the stage to San Antonio, where she boarded the new train connecting that city with Houston. And at Victoria, she dismounted to catch the famous old train that chugged its way out to Indianola. It left Victoria at 9 in the morning and steamed into Indianola at 1:30 in the afternoon. She joined her brother on Friday, the 13th of August, 1886, and shared with him some of the best weeks of her life. For Theo spoke both of his burgeoning hopes for the future, which excited her, and of his memories of the Margravate, which reminded her of how happy she had been as a child. They were old people now, he 64, she 57, and the bitter memories receded as the good ones prevailed. "Does your tenor voice, can you still sing so beautifully?" she asked, and he tried a few notes. "We have a singing society here, you know," he told her, "but I yield the lead tenor to others." On Sunday, when they both attended the German church at his suggestion, he apologized. "Father wouldn't approve of our going to church, but times are different now." He then took her for a delightful buggy ride in one of his own carriages. They rode out to the great bayous east of town, where he stopped to explain the winds of a hurricane. "They come in three parts. A fierce storm blows from west to east. Tremendous noise and rain, but not much damage. Then a lull, like a summer day, as the eye passes over. Then a much wilder storm from east to west, and it's the one that blows everything down." "Why does one kill and not the other?" "Neither kills. Oh, a tree falling or some other freak accident." "What does?" "This does." And he pointed to the flat, empty lands basking in the sun, so quiet and peaceful that they could not be imagined as threatening anyone. "You see, Vranza, tidal waves throw immense quantities of water onto these flat places, so much you wouldn't believe it. And as the storm abates, it has to go somewhere, and with a great rush it finds its way back to sea." He dropped his head, recalling that tremendous surge of trapped water that had destroyed so much of Indianola. "It took 30 hours to build up. High tides, rain, hurricane winds. It ran back in two, an irresistible torrent." "How did you survive?" They were speaking in German, and he replied, "Ein wahres Wunder." "And prudence. I guessed that the retreating waters would be dangerous, so I took our family to the upper floor of the strongest building in town, not my own, and tied us all to heavy beds, not lying down, of course, just to the heavy iron pieces. And it worked. When the water swirled past, clutching at everything, we could see it sucking people to their deaths. It tried with us, right through that second floor, but we were tied fast." He chuckled. "It tore away my wife's clothes, all of them, and she screamed for the rescue party not to save us." He laughed again. "Water can do the strangest things." "Will it come again?" "Records show that once a hurricane hits, it never hits that spot again. That's how I've been able to hold the town together. We know we're safe. Only the cowards fled." Indianola, under his driving leadership, had restored itself as the premier port in South Texas, and many predicted that it must soon outdistance Galveston. It was clear to Francisca, from the respect in which the citizens held her brother, that this revitalization was due primarily to his optimism, and she saw that he was much like his father. "Remember, Theo, how during the worst days of our Atlantic crossing he kept spirits high? You're like him." On Tuesday, Franza and her brother entertained a John Methuli's seafood restaurant, and the guests, most with German names, shared an enjoyable evening of fine oysters, rich crabs, and other succulent viands which could not be surpassed this side of Baltimore, the menu boasted. and equaled in only a handful of the superior establishments in that German city. After the meal, there was singing, and at 10, ice cream, made possible by the new ice machine, was served. It was accompanied by 4 kinds of cookies, baked that afternoon by Franziska. This was followed by more singing and a speech by Theo, "The Unlimited Progress Possible When Rails Marry Steam," which alluded to the impending railroad linkage of Indianola, San Antonio, and Brownsville. When they left the restaurant, with some of the men still singing, Franziska became aware of a sharp change in the weather, for while they were dining, an excessively humid wind had blown in from the Gulf, and although this disturbed her, it pleased her brother. "Rain. We've needed it since July." But this wind did not bring rain. Instead, when Franziska rose next morning, she found Indianola enveloped in billows of dust. And when she accompanied her brother on a visit to Captain Isaac Reed, the United States Signal Service man who now monitored storms in the area, he showed them a telegram he had received from Washington. "West Indian hurricane passed South Key West into Gulf, causing high winds southern Florida. Stop. Will probably cause gales on coast of eastern Gulf states tonight." When Franziska asked, "Isn't that serious?" he assured her, "Government follows these things carefully, and 99 times out of 100 such storms collapse and produce no more than a slight rise in our tide." But later that morning, when the winds became more intense, Theo and Franza returned to the weather office, and Theo, as the elder statesman, asked, "Shouldn't you hoist the danger signal?" And Reed said, "Washington would warn us if such a signal was advisable. Rest easy. This storm will die." Later, Captain Reed did receive a frantic telegram from Washington warning of the immediate descent of a full hurricane. But now it was too late. Within minutes, the hurricane came roaring in, and before Reed could respond, telegraph lines were whipping in the wind. Reed was a valiant man, and when it looked as if his signal service was going to be blown away, he stayed inside to screw down the anemometer so that the maximum velocity of the wind could be recorded. It hit 102 miles an hour before it and the building were simply blown apart. Reed and a medical man, Dr. Rosencrans, were struck by falling timbers as they tried to scramble away, and the incoming waves submerged them. They were seen no more. When the building fell, a kerosene lamp was thrown to the floor, and its flames were whipped about so violently by the roaring winds, which now gusted to 152 miles an hour, that within an incredible 11 minutes, the entire main street was in flames, and residents in panic tried to escape the fire. The hurricane of 1875, which they said could never be repeated, was now reborn, with a fury more terrible than before. Theo Ollerkamp, whose ship's Chandlery was struck by the first awesome blast of fire, managed to escape the instant conflagration produced when his turpentine and tar exploded into flame. And for one hellish moment, he watched as the street he had rebuilt was attacked by flame on its rooftops and flood at its foundations. Buildings spewed sparks hundreds of feet into the storm, then sighed and collapsed as the irresistible flood tore away their walls. "Mein Gott," he cried, "what are you doing to us?" Mindful of how a hurricane worked, he shouted to those other bewildered men who saw their life's energies destroyed, "Prepare for the back surge." To repeat the precautions which had saved his family before, he struggled through the rising waters to his home, where his sister stood pressed against the wall, protecting herself from the tremendous winds and watching the fiery destruction of her brother's handiwork. "Oh, Theo," she cried, as he staggered up the 3 wooden steps, which had not yet been washed away by the waters that attacked them. "How could such punishment come to so good a man?" He had no time for lamentation, even though flame and flood nearly engulfed him. "When the calm comes, then's the danger." And he led her to the highest spot in his house, built to withstand floods such as that of 1875, and fetched ropes with which to bind her to its walls when the waters began to recede. This time, that would not work. For when the tempestuous wind, now gusting occasionally to more than 165 miles, whipped about. It brought with it a summer's sky of flaming meteors. The clouds were filled with embers, thousands of them, and they arched in beauty over the dark space, reaching for the houses not yet aflame. "We shall burn," Theo cried, not in desperation or in fear, and he ripped away the ropes that bound his sister to the wall and thrust them into her hands. "To the trees." But before they could escape, 100 blazing embers fell on the Allerkamp house, and a like number on those nearby. In one vast, sighing gasp, heard above the howling of the wind, these houses exploded into leaping flame, and those who had not anticipated this likelihood perished. Waiting for a lull, Theo and his sister headed for the few trees in Indianola, scrawny things barely meriting the name, and she reached them, but he did not. A wave, wilder than any before, came far inland, caught him by the heels, tumbled him about as if he were a wooden toy, then tossed him with terrible force back against one of the newly burning houses. Nothing could have saved him, and he died in the center of the town he had built beside the sea, and then rebuilt.